we are going to do Esther, seeing as how we have Purim coming up next month. And one of the resources I am using is a book called The Dawn by a gentleman named Yoram Hazoni. He's a Jew, not Messianic, and he goes into lots of political stuff in that process. Very good insights. I go up and down on some of his insights, but by and large, they're very good. So I will just let you know now that very often I'll be referring to him. So anyway, Esther is one of the four books of exile. The first of the books of exile is Joseph in the book of Genesis, where Joseph is exiled by his brothers and winds up as viceroy of Egypt and winds up saving his people. The next one, of course, is the book of Exodus, which is the chronicle of Moses from exile, saving his people. The next one is the book of Daniel. And so far as I know, Daniel does not personally save the Jews. And in that, he is an outlier of the other three. And then the one we have today, which is Esther, and that is again Jews rising to political power in exile for the purpose, among other things, of saving the Jews. So you should sense a theme going on there. As I've said a number of times, each of the heroes and heroines of the exile is from a different tribe. So, of course, Joseph is from the tribe of Joseph. Moses is from the tribe of Levi. Daniel is from the tribe of Judah, and of course, Esther and Mordecai are from the tribe of Benjamin. One of the things that I am always struck by is that I read these exile tales and I compare them with what Jacob and Moses both said about the 12 tribes. You can see that each of these men in exile very much reflects the character of the tribe he comes from. I've always found that very fascinating. Hazoni's perspective on this, which is a good one, I think, is the problem of exile is that Jews don't inherently have any power. So when Israel is in the land and they are under an Israelite government, they have secular power as well as social and religious power, because that's their nation. When they get sent into exile, they are sent into a place where they are in a minority, and they don't have any power per se. And if they're going to exercise any power, they're going to have to develop it within the system wherein they're exiled. So, for example, he talks about Joseph, who, when he goes into exile in Egypt, proceeds to be blessed by God in everything he touches, and is also given the ability to interpret dreams. And the combination of those two things gets him first noticed by the captain of the guard, who was his original owner. And then when he gets framed by Potiphar's wife, Potiphar simply moves him laterally within his own organization from his own personal household into the prison, which he also runs. The fact that his wife mousetrapped him on that annoys him no end, but he's not going to lose Joseph and his abilities. And then, of course, he rises to viceroy of Egypt, and in that capacity, he then saves the Jews. Excellent administrator, and as we've said many times in Midrash, completely loyal to Pharaoh, which we'll talk about in just a minute. Moses, of course, is born in exile and saved from being crocodile chow, and is adopted into the royal family by the daughter of Pharaoh. And then after his return with the burning bush, I very much suspect that the reason he is able to waltz in and out of the throne room of Pharaoh is because he is a known quantity. He isn't just some random Hebrew that is out there stomping on bricks. And in that process, he saves the Jews, and again, his temperament is completely different. not a bad administrator, but that's not really what his strength is. In fact, you could argue that his strength is not an administration at all, because his father-in-law has to tell him, wait a minute, you cannot listen to everybody's complaints and judge between them. You'll wear yourself out and you'll wear them out. So it's actually his father-in-law who gives him the idea of setting up an administration beyond himself. And then, of course, Daniel, the book of Daniel is in historical time, just a very few years before the book of Esther, because Daniel is alive at the beginning of the Persian Empire, and we'll see tonight that Esther is not very far into the Persian Empire, so they're very close. The thing about Daniel is, again, he is given the ability to interpret dreams, and he proves himself useful and loyal to the king, and so rises to the top of the empire, both in Babylonian Empire and in the Medo-Persian Empire. And by the time of Esther, I expect, of course, he's passed on. And then, of course, we have Mordecai and Esther, who rise to the top of their particular empire. They, interestingly, do it by wiping people out. As far as I know, Joseph never kills anybody. Moses does, when he puts down the rebellion of Korah. He also killed the Egyptian. So Moses, being a Levite, is perfectly capable of slaughtering great numbers of people when he needs to. Joseph never does. Daniel never does. They are both very capable and both certainly in charge when they're put in charge. But as far as I know, neither one of them ever kills anybody. And then, of course, Mordecai will rise to prominence by taking out the second in command of the Persian Empire, and he will be killed. Right, where we are in time. In back of me, there is a map up on the screen of the Persian Empire in the period we're talking about. If you go to Wikipedia, they will tell you that the Book of Esther is fictional because there is no King Ahasuerus, and none of them ever had a wife named Vashti. Do with that as seems good to you. The Jews in the Jewish book call Xerxes Ahasuerus. They do that several places. And where I think we are, most scholars do too, even though Wikipedia doesn't know, is we are in the reign of Xerxes I. He is the son of Darius the Great. So Darius was from 522 BC to 486 BC. Then Xerxes I, who I think is the protagonist here in this book of Esther, was from 465 BC to 424 BC. Now, this great feast that everything starts off with is in the third year of his reign. So that would be in 462 BC. There is some question about why he's doing this. The thing to understand is you look at the empire back there, you'll notice that it doesn't include Greece. Darius had tried to conquer Greece, and he got repulsed at the Battle of Marathon, you know, the place where we name the race after. So one of the things that the commentary that goes with my Bible program posits is Xerxes is going to repeat that in a couple of years from where the feast is. So what that commentary posits is that this great gathering of all of the officials in the empire is for purposes of getting things organized and getting everybody on the same sheet of music, because we're going to go conquer Greece. What they tried to do under Darius is they crossed the land bridge, the Hellespont, and came across Thrace and were coming down into Achaia. And that's when they got stopped at the Battle of Marathon. Xerxes will do the same thing. They'll try and do the same thing, which is stop him at Thermopylae. What will happen at Thermopylae, which is a very narrow pass from north to south on the Greek peninsula, is a shepherd will betray the Greeks and lead the Persians around that narrow pass, and they will then wipe out the Greeks at Thermopylae. Then there will be a series of naval battles where they burn Athens, for example, and eventually they will be defeated in naval battles and will recoil. But that is quite a bit after where we are in the Book of Esther. So the commentary that goes up my Bible program posits that perhaps what this big empire-wide gathering is all about is to get everything in order for the campaign against Greece. Hazzoni, on the other hand, says that it is nothing but an ego trip on the part of Xerxes. He's a young ruler, it's the third year, and boy, he's just puffing himself up and giving a big party, and look how great I am, and the whole thing is a massive ego trip. That's Hazzoni's perspective. So whether or not this particular gathering had a practical imperial purpose of organizing things, because you got all the governors of all the provinces and what resources do we have, that kind of thing, and getting all that organized for the Greek campaign, or whether it's simply an ego trip on the part of a new king, take your pick. So Esther, chapter 1, verse 1. Now in the days of Ahasuerus, the Ahasuerus who reigned from India to Ethiopia over 127 provinces, in those days, when King Ahasuerus sat on the royal throne in Susa, the capital, in the third year of his reign, he gave a feast for all his officials and servants. Susa, by the way, is in the mountains here east of the Euphrates River. It's basically a summer capital, if you will, because the weather is nice and cool up there, and you don't want to be down on the plain of the Euphrates because it's hot and muggy. So he gave a feast for all his officials and servants. The army of Persia and Media and the nobles and the governors of the provinces were before him. So he has got his entire administration there. So the governors of the provinces were before him, while he showed the riches of his royal glory and the splendor and pomp of his greatness for many days, 180 days. So 6 months this meeting lasts. So he's got all the bigwigs there for 6 months while he feasts and wines and dines and all that kind of stuff. Hazzoni's perspective on this is basically nothing but an ostentatious waste of time to show everybody how magnificent and powerful he is. Now, certainly that is a component. There's no question about that. But the question of whether that's the motive for the gathering is, scripture is silent, so take your pick, whichever you like. Verse 5, and when these days were completed, the king gave for all the people present in Susa, the citadel, both great and small, a feast lasting for 7 days in the court of the garden of the king's palace. So you got the city of Susa, which is a citadel, the summer capital, if you will. And at the end of the 6 months where he's got all the bigwigs in there, he throws the place open to everybody who lives in town. And that lasts for 7 days. Verse 6, there were white cotton curtains and violet hangings, and fastened with cords of fine linen and purple to silver rods, and marble pillars, and also couches of gold and silver on a mosaic pavement of porphyry, marble, mother of pearl, and precious stones. Drinks were served in golden vessels, vessels of different kinds, and the royal wine was lavish according to the bounty of the king. So it was a world-class barbecue. Everybody shows up, open bar, the entire town. Verse 8, and drinking was according to this edict. There is no compulsion. That's important. If you are invited to have cocktails with the king, it would be an insult to say, no, sorry, I don't drink. So the idea that I don't care whether you're a teetotaler or not, you've been invited to have cocktails with the king, you're going to have cocktails and you're going to enjoy yourself. The edict then that there was no compulsion is to give them the ability to come in and look the place over, be amazed by the grandeur of it, eat some hot chicken wings and all that kind of stuff, but you don't actually have to get drunk if you don't want to. Hazzoni talks about that, and he says what that is a masterstroke, because everybody in Susa or Persia is at the sufferance of the emperor. And so to give somebody a little bit of freedom makes them think that this is really a good guy. Hazzoni's take on it is that that edict is by way of giving everybody the impression that they are not, in fact, slaves, because you got some choice here. So there is no compulsion. For the king had given orders to all his staff of his palace to do as each man desired. In other words, nobody in the staff was to look at somebody who decided he wanted lemonade instead of wine, like, what's wrong with you? You don't want the king's wine? Huh? That's what the edict is for. Queen Vashti also gave a feast for the women in the palace that belonged to King Ahasuerus. Now, the feast that she is given is for the palace bureaucrats. It is not for the whole town, which is what Ahasuerus is given. Slightly different. On the seventh day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, he commanded Memuhan, Biztha, Harbona, Bigtha, and Abagtha, Zether, and Carcas, the seven eunuchs who served in the presence of King Ahasuerus, to bring Queen Vashti before the king with her royal crown in order to show the peoples and the princes her beauty, for she was lovely to look at. So what Hazzoni says is this is, again, just part of the ego trip. You know, look at my beautiful palace. Look at everybody that I can make come and have a party with me. Look at all my power. And oh, by the way, look at this babe I married. Verse 12. But Queen Vashti refused to come at the king's command delivered by the eunuchs. At this, the king became enraged, and his anger burned within him. I would guess so. The idea here that the queen, when her husband has set himself up in front of the entire empire and said, please go get me my queen, and she says no, that's lack of respect on steroids. So the fact that he's enraged, I think, is completely understandable. Now, it may not have been in good taste for him to actually ask for her. That's a different question. But having done so, I can see why he's upset. So the king, and this is according to Hazzoni now, plays it brilliantly. Then the king said to the wise men who knew the times, for this was the king's procedure toward all who were vexed in law and judgment, the men next to him being Karshena, Shethar, Admata, Tarshish, Marish, Marcena, and Memucan, the seven princes of Persia and Medina, who saw the king's face and sat first in the kingdom. So he's got seven governors of his province. When it says he saw the king's face, these are people who get into the king's presence and talk to him face to face, as opposed to talking to him through intermediaries. Verse 15, according to the law, what is to be done to Queen Vashti because she has not performed the command of King Ahasuerus delivered by his eunuchs? What he has done is he has elevated a family spat to a level of state. And in that, what he's done is he has moved himself from a guy whose wife won't do what he wants to. He has elevated himself now. I am the head of state. The state has been insulted here. How should we handle it? That's what he's done. Verse 16. Then Memucan said in the presence of the king and the officials, not only against the king has Queen Vashti done wrong, but also against all the officials and all the peoples who are in all the province of King Ahasuerus. In other words, he didn't just insult you, she insulted the entire empire. As I say, he's elevated this whole thing from a squabble between husband and wife to an affair of state. 17. For the queen's behavior will be made known to all women, causing them to look at their husbands with contempt, since they will say, King Ahasuerus commanded Queen Vashti to be brought before him, and she did not come. This very day, the noble women of Persia and Media who have heard of the queen's behavior will say the same to all the king's officials, and there will be contempt and wrath in plenty. The last thing we want is this stuff to spread. 19. If it please the king, let a royal order go out from him, and let it be written among the laws of the Persians and the Medes, so that it cannot be repealed, that Vashti is never again to come before King Ahasuerus, and let the king give her royal position to another who is better than she. Notice this is not his recommendation. This is his advisor's recommendation. What he's done is he has moved this from husband and wife to emperor and emperor's cabinet, from personal to political. Verse 20. So when the decree made by the king is proclaimed throughout all his kingdom, for it is vast, all women will give honor to their husbands, high and low alike. This advice pleased the king and the princes, and the king did as Memucan proposed. He sent letters to all the royal provinces, to every province in its own script, and to every people in its own language, that every man be master of his own household and speak according to the language of his people. So, mistakes often have consequences. And this one certainly did. Chapter 2. After these things, when the anger of King Ahasuerus had abated, he remembered Vashti and what he had done and what had been decreed against her. At that point, he sort of regretted what he had done. Now, understand, and this is according to Hazzoni, his problem is not sexual. He has a harem. He's going to have a greater harem. The problem is Vashti was apparently someone he could talk to, someone who was actually a wife to him, as opposed to one of the playthings in the harem. And he misses that at this point. It's not the case that he is simply missing her in bed, although that may be the case too, but what he's missing is having an actual wife as opposed to a stable. And I think that's a good observation. Verse 2. Then the king's young men who attended him said, let beautiful young virgins be brought out for the king, and let the king appoint officers in all the provinces of his kingdoms to gather all the beautiful young virgins to the harem of Susa, the capital, under custody of Haggai, the king's eunuch, who is in charge of the women. Let their cosmetics be given them. Let the young woman who pleases the king be queen instead of Vashti. This pleased the king, and he did so. This is rape. The young women don't have any choice. You've got talent scouts out there checking. They find one that they think will please the king. They get taken. They get certainly moved into the harem, which is, from a comfort point of view, a really good gig. They'll be taken care of. They get one shot at pleasing the king, and if they don't please the king, they go into another section of the harem, and they will then die alone. Because once they have been in the bed of the king, if you will, it would be completely inappropriate for them to marry somebody else. So they have no choice about this. They got one shot, and if they aren't the one chosen, then their life will be comfortable. They'll be well fed. They'll be warm. They'll be cared for. But that's it. The king will never see him again because he doesn't care. So this is basically sex slavery, if you will. Verse 5. Now there was a Jew in Susa, the citadel, whose name was Mordecai, the son of Yair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjaminite. So he is a relation of Solomon, who was also the son of Kish, who had been carried away from Jerusalem among the captives, carried away with Jeconiah, the king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, had carried away. He was bringing up Hadassah, that is, Esther, the daughter of his uncle, for she had neither father nor mother. The young woman had a beautiful figure and was lovely to look at. And when her father and her mother died, Mordecai took her in as his own daughter. Hadassah is her Hebrew name. Esther is a Persian name. Esther means star. She will hereafter be called Esther and not Hadassah. So she is an orphan, and her cousin is taking care of her, who is obviously an older man. Verse 8. So when the king's order and his edict were proclaimed, and when many young women were gathered in Susa in the citadel in custody of Haggai, Esther also was taken into the king's palace and put in custody of Haggai, who had charge of the women. And the young woman pleased him and won his favor, and he quickly provided her with her cosmetics and her portion of food with 7 chosen young women from the king's palace and advanced her and her young women to the best place in the harem. We'll talk about that in just a minute. Verse 10, Esther had not made known her people or kindred, for Mordecai had commanded her not to make it known. Now, I don't know why that is, because one of the things that is going on is he is scooping up young babes from all over the empire. So I'm sure he's got them from Western India all the way to Egypt and so forth. So the fact that she is not ethnically Persian, I wouldn't think would bother anybody. So I'm not sure why Mordecai has told her not to disclose that she's Hebrew or Jewish. Just don't know. Obviously, it is going to become important to the story. 11. And every day Mordecai walked in front of the court of the harem to learn how Esther was and what was happening to her. So he kept track of her. Now, when the turn came for each young woman to go in to King Ahasuerus, after being 12 months under the regulation for the women, since this was the regular period of their beautifying, 6 months with oil and myrrh and 6 months with spices and ointments. It sounds like a marinade. 13, try again. When the young women went into the king in this way, she was given whatever she desired to take with her from the harem to the king's palace. So this is her one shot. And so she was allowed to take anything she wanted with her, except probably a knife. She wanted to take a musical instrument. She could sing and play. So from Haggai's point of view, he wants this to succeed. He wants every young woman to be a wonderful experience for the emperor, because that's his job. So he will do whatever that woman thinks will help her in that process. 13, when the young woman went into the king this way, she was given whatever she desired to take with her from the harem to the king's palace. In the evening, she would go in, and in the morning, she would return to the second harem in custody of Shaagaz, the king's eunuch, who was in charge of the concubines. She would not go in to the king again unless the king delighted in her and she was summoned by name. So you got two stables of women. The ones who haven't yet auditioned, the ones who have been with the king and are not the queen, and they're now in the court of the concubines, different part of the compound. And as I say, if you don't make the cut, that's where you are for the rest of your life. Verse 15. When the term came for Esther, the daughter of Abihail, uncle of Mordecai, who had taken her as his own daughter to go into the king, she asked for nothing except what Haggai the king's eunuch, who had charge of the women, advised. Now Esther was winning favor in the lives of all who saw her. So what she has been doing constantly is she has been doing her best to get in good with Haggai. When she gets ready to go in for her shot, she turns to Haggai because Haggai knows everything about the king and his preferences. And of course, Haggai's job depends on him pleasing the king. When she comes to him and says, "All right, what do I need to do here?" He gives her the best advice that he can. So all of this is by way of showing that she is doing her best to succeed in the situation she finds herself in. You remember in Jeremiah when he writes a letter to the exiles in Babylon and they're on the verge of rebellion, and he writes them a letter and says, "You're going to be there 70 years. So, seek the good of the place where you are. Because the better it is where you are, and the better you make it, the better your exile will be. That is what Esther is doing. She is in a situation she didn't choose. She's a virtual sex slave. And so she wants to make that as successful as possible for her own benefit. 16. And when Esther was taken to King Ahasuerus into his royal palace in the 10th month, which is the month of Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign. Now notice this is 4 years after the big party. In the 7th year of his reign, the king loved Esther more than all the women, and she won grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins, so that he set the royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. Then the king gave a great feast for all his officials and servants. It was Esther's feast. He also granted remission of taxes to the provinces and gave gifts with royal generosity. So I have found myself a wife. Verse 19. Now when the virgins were gathered together the second time, Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate. Esther had not made known her kindred or her people, as Mordecai had commanded her. For Esther obeyed Mordecai just as when she was brought up by him. In those days, as Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate, Bigthan and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs, who guarded the threshold, became angry and sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. And this came to the knowledge of Mordecai, and he told it to Queen Esther. And Esther told the king in the name of Mordecai. When the affair was investigated and found to be so, the men were both hanged on the gallows, and it was recorded in the book of the Chronicles in the presence of the king. I am now channeling Hazoni. Mordecai, just like Esther, has decided to make himself a political player in the kingdom. For him to sit in the gate like that is to put himself in a place where he is going to be able to get gossip and so forth about what's going on in the court. So when he gets some gossip about what's going down, that there's a coup about to be taken place, he can do two things. One is he can ignore it and find out who the rebels are and get on their good side in case they win. Or he can warn the king, in which case he is taking a risk. Because if the rebels succeed and he has warned the king, he will be regarded then as their enemy after the rebellion. Now, as a matter of fact, the rebels do not succeed. So what he has now done is he has identified himself as someone who will take a risk in the king's behalf. I used to be a commander. And one of the things that I wanted from my subordinates is when I'm not there, and I haven't told you what to do in this situation, think about what you think I would do and then do it. Or think about what you think I would tell you to do and then do it. The last thing I want to see when I finally catch up with you is have you sitting around saying, nobody told me what to do. And so when Hazoni says the thing that is valuable to anybody in power is somebody who can be trusted to act on the boss's behalf when the boss is not there. Someone who will take initiative on the boss's behalf when the boss is not there. As Hazoni said, and it's absolutely true, sycophants are a dime a dozen. They're expendable because they don't have any initiative. But when you find somebody who can take initiative and do the right thing and will do it on your behalf when you're not there, that is someone valuable. That's what Mordecai does. And of course, we'll see later that that becomes the key, if you will, to the rest of the book. Joseph does the same thing. Joseph, when he gets elevated to viceroy, proceeds to basically bring all of Egypt under the control of Pharaoh. Remember, he sells the food, and when the money runs out, then he buys their land for food. And when their land is all sold, then he buys them as serfs for food. So at the end of that time, all of Egypt are now serfs, and Pharaoh owns all of the land. Joseph did that for him. Daniel, same thing. Daniel is able to interpret the dream. Daniel is able to take action on behalf of Nebuchadnezzar and his successor. And so Daniel gradually rises to be number two in the empire because the emperor recognizes that this is a guy who will take independent action on my behalf even when I'm not around. That's what Mordecai does. That's what Esther is doing. So Esther, when she is given the opportunity to spend the night with the king, has done her homework. She has ingratiated herself with the eunuch because she's taking his advice. She has ingratiated herself with the eunuch to begin with, because I'm sure as soon as she got in there, she went to him and says, "All right, what do I need to do to make you look good? I look good, we know that. What do I need to do to make you look good?" And so the eunuch, "Oh, wow, this one's a keeper." And I'm sure he probably talks her up and all that kind of stuff. So both Mordecai and Esther have decided, this is where I am. I'm not going to take over the empire, at least not yet. So I will do whatever I need to do to get myself into A, a position of influence, and B, make my lot and the lot of my people as good as it can be. We have everything set up now. So the stage is set, if you will. We've got all the players in place, and we'll next go into chapter 3 and play out the sequence.